WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Carrie Nolan. Let's talk about women in the boardroom. Last year, in 2021, a survey from the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that just 29% of corporate executives were women. Structural sexism means there are more obstacles on the corporate ladder for women. And that's in 2022, over a century since suffragists succeeded in winning the right for women to vote. Now, we're going to talk about one woman who raised herself up from poverty, probably from sex work, into high society, until finally landing at the head of one of the nation's most powerful publishing companies, decades before any woman could legally cast a ballot. Her name was Miriam Leslie, and before now, very little was known about her. People took her at her word when she claimed to be descended from French aristocrats, when in reality her father was a sort of degenerate gambler, and her birth mother was likely one of the women that he enslaved. Throughout her life, Miriam used powder to lighten her complexion and clung to the story of her high-class lineage, although she was raised in the tenements of New York City. These new details about Miriam Leslie's life come from a new biography called Diamonds and Deadlines, a tale of greed, deceit, and a female tycoon in the Gilded Age by cultural historian Betsy Priolo. Kirkus Reviews says of Miriam, the book's subject, quote, "They just don't make characters like this anymore. Kudos." Betsy Priolo joins me right now to discuss her book about the rags-to-riches publishing tycoon Miriam Leslie. Betsy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Carrie. So much fun to be here.
When did you first come across Miriam Leslie's story, and what about her made you want to keep probing into her life?
Well, it's fascinating because I wrote about her early on in a book, Seductress. She plays a cameo role there. And when the centennial of the 19th Amendment rolled around, I got curious about her again. And I went back to the court cases, and there was a great challenge there where her opponents charged that she was mixed race and that her mother was an enslaved woman from her father's background. And I thought, that's interesting. And it turns out that the official account of Miriam's life, which she created and marketed through the press, which she owned, was a complete fabrication. And that everything that I thought, even in Seductress, was wrong. So the dig began. It was absolutely fascinating what I discovered.
So let's talk a little bit about your research process. How did you get Miriam to essentially reveal herself?
Well, it was a long process, but an absolutely intriguing one. First of all, there were the square papers at the New York Historical Society, which were incredible insight into her second husband's character and their marriage. But in South Carolina, I came across some very curious information, not just Charles, her father's life and experiences and background in Charleston, but also Nick Butler, a researcher at the Charleston County Library, came across a thought to be lost inventory that contained a list of the possible enslaved women who might have been Miriam's mother, which was a terrific find. But in addition to that, I was able to have access to hundreds and hundreds of pages of Supreme Court records via Google. And they contained a trove. There were letters, there were reproduced old court cases, there were affidavits that were just extraordinary. So that was one of my major sources. But then there were, during COVID, accessible archives where I could go back and read all of the Frank Leslie Illustrated newspapers online, which, not to mention newspapers.com. So I really think that technology really aided this deep dive that I did.
You write, as you just mentioned, that her mother was probably a woman who was enslaved by her father. What do we know about who Miriam's parents are? And you know, you came to a certain conclusion about that. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, so much evidence pointed to the fact that she really was the daughter of one of her father's enslaved women. In the absence of DNA evidence, of course, I couldn't prove it, but there were lots of clues. First of all, Miriam's supposed mother, Susan Danforth, I never even visited New Orleans until Miriam was 6 years old. She wasn't on the scene at all. Mm-hmm. People throughout Miriam's life commented on her, quote, Creole features. And Creole then was code for Black or mixed race. But I think that one of the strongest pieces of evidence was the person who was actually on the scene, Miriam's stepsister, Amelia Trescott. She lived in the house there, and she said, of course, everyone knew that Miriam was the daughter of one of her father's enslaved women. So I think that was a strong proof. Also, lots of people attested to the fact that they knew it. People in New York, this was all in the Supreme Court records buried away. So I thought there was enough evidence there to make a good guess that this was probably her mother, combined with the fact, of course, that she was constantly using pearl powder and dyeing her hair and using cosmetic aids in order to cover the fact that she might look that way. When she went to New Orleans once for one of her visits, a reporter commented on her Creole features. So this was ongoing throughout her life, that people suspected it, people commented on it. But of course, she was in deep denial.
Now, she did claim to have had an aristocratic upbringing in New Orleans. And as you say, she was actually raised in poverty. And also, you write that she probably turned to sex work for survival. Can you paint a picture for us of what it meant to be a poor young woman in New York in the 1850s?
Yeah, I think it's hard for us to wrap our minds around all of that. It was really a tragic situation for her because at 16, her only means of support dried up. Her guardian, her uncle, fell ill, and she was cast on her own resources, and she faced some very stark choices. The opportunities for women were incredibly few. You could make as much as 75 cents a week for piecework, brutal piecework, or you could earn as much as $5 a night for sex work. Actually, 20% of the New York City population then were engaged in prostitution. So the temptation must have been tremendous, especially since the wolf was at the door. Her father was a non-provider. Her mother was desperate. There was nobody there to help her. She was literally alone at the mercy of this very cruel, hostile environment. So she entered the sex trade. We know that because Miriam's second husband was one of her clients, and when she betrayed him in order to get a divorce with a an adultery sting, which is another story, he retaliated and spilled the beans about her background. So that's how we know what actually happened. But once she entered the trade, she began to rise through the ranks. She, first of all, engineered a shotgun marriage. To be married in the business raised your profile enormously. And then she became the mistress of a Tennessee congressman, William Churchwell. We know that too from the records. And then achieved a respectable marriage with E.G. Square, a prominent anthropologist. And of course, that led to a marriage to the publishing tycoon, Frank Leslie. And that basically put her in business.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the rungs of that ladder that she was climbing. By the way, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Betsy Prilo. She's a cultural historian and author of the new book, Diamonds and Deadlines, A Tale of Greed, Deceit, and a Female Tycoon in the Gilded Age. You wrote, you know, she begins to make money and she starts to upgrade her wardrobe and her accessories. And you say that diamonds and jewelry became sort of talismans for her. And that's how she meets her first husband. So tell us about that shotgun wedding, as you described it.
Oh, yeah, that was an incredible story. In order to, as I said before, if you were in the sex trade then, to have Mrs. in front of your name was a tremendous asset. And she orchestrated an incredible sting. She met a jewelry clerk, and in exchange for diamonds in the window, she gave him her sexual favors. But she then accused him of seduction after that, which was punishable by 5 years in the Tombs. This was New York's very worst prison. And then Frog marched him into a marriage and an instant annulment. So this poor man was basically press ganged into this marriage. And the quick annulment was ideal because that way she didn't have to live with him, but she was immediately actually re-virginated because in order to be seduced, you had to be a pure woman. So it enhanced her reputation in two ways. She became a married woman briefly and also became a pure woman, at least in name.
She marries her second husband, who E.G. Square, who was an archaeologist and a writer and an aspiring railroad entrepreneur. And how long did that marriage last?
Actually, they were married for 7 years. And what happened there was very curious. She and Square didn't get along even from the beginning. And as soon as Frank Leslie entered the scene. This was the print baron of the great Leslie empire. He left his wife and moved in with the Squeers. He hired Square for his newspaper, and they lived in a heated ménage à trois for almost 10 years.
Wow.
So it was an incredibly scandalous arrangement. But Miriam denied everything. It was fascinating the way she spun this whole story. She laundered her erotic escapades and just denied it and said she was a perfectly respectable person. And she was such a good master of image and of public persona that she was able to pull it off. It's absolutely extraordinary.
Now, all of this leads Miriam into taking her first steps into publishing, and she wound up playing a major role in that industry. What made her so good as the editor of what had at the time been the ailing Frank Leslie's Ladies Magazine?
You know, she had an amazing publishing instinct. She was a brilliant, brilliant journalist. She had her ear to the ground. antennae for what people wanted. And it was curious because she herself was in a role that violated the ideal feminine ideal, the feminine role of the day. And yet she, in as an editor, had to think of financial realities and circulation numbers. So she promoted the patriarchal standard view of the true woman, which most of her readers accepted, whether by choice of necessity. So she had her handle on exactly what they wanted. And what they really wanted, besides ratification of their role, was escape, sentimentality, some of the anodynes that made their sort of domestic imprisonment possible. She was excellent at tuning out unpleasant news of the Civil War and playing into what women could fantasize about, being glamorous, being high society, and being adored by men. That whole romantic fantasy.
Now, when Frank Leslie died in 1880, Miriam got ready for a nasty court battle over his estate with Frank's kids from his first marriage. She wanted to present a very specific image in court. Can we talk about that for a moment or two?
Yes, that was an incredibly clever performance. She was totally outgunned. Frank Leslie's sons contested the will. Frank Leslie, when he died, left everything to Miriam. He left his brand. He even left his name, Frank Leslie, and the entire empire. So the sons were enraged, and they tried to blacken Miriam's character. This is where I got a lot of information, too, about her past, because they dredged it all up. They dredged up her adulterous affair with Frank Leslie, and they portrayed her as a kind of monster, a woman who had de-sexed herself by going into business. This was a very, very common stereotype. Also, she was a seductress, a witch, and so on. She had so many men come forward and testify to her poor character that it looked like the case was going to go against her. But she was incredibly shrewd. She, by the way, had a background in acting. And so she portrayed herself as a stricken widow and brought in a sort of Praetorian guard of respectable women to testify to her character. And very wisely never took the stand, but she found a woman, probably an actress, from Denver, who stood up and gave firsthand accounts of Frank Leslie and his death and how Miriam was such a saint and begged Frank not to leave all the money to her and how she welcomed the sons and so on. And then the lawyer, who she had well coached, stood up and blacken the characters of the two sons with information that only Miriam could have known. And as a result, she won the case. It was a real coup, but part of her shrewdness. This woman was a very, very clever, crafty operator and had to be in this very cruel, sexist world where all the odds were against her.
Well, you know, after Frank Leslie's death, she wound up being engaged two more times, and then she married Oscar Wilde's brother, Willie Wilde. And when she died in 1914, she left suffragist Carrie Chapman Catt the equivalent of $50 million in today's money to use to further the cause of women's rights. Betsy, before we let you go, and this is a fascinating book, what lessons did you take away from the life of Mrs. Frank Leslie?
Well, it's really interesting. she's a woman you both love and hate, and there's a lot to dislike. I mean, she was egocentric, vain, bigoted, and a snob, very hard-boiled character who used her wiles and used a Machiavellian route to power. Some of these things don't go down well today, but I took away a sort of backhanded admiration for her because she had stupendous obstacles to overcome, and she used grit, fortitude, and a tremendous intelligence to achieve what she did. I was also impressed that she had lessons for us today if we want to take them and co-opt them and for our own business uses. She was a genius of image management, and she understood the arts of management with a velvet hand in an iron hand in a velvet glove. She was a real soft power expert whose management skills were something I found extraordinary. The other thing that I took away from her is that in a time when women have lost a lot of sexual agency, she made a big point that women should have control of their erotic destinies and gave that a lot of thought. She might not have made all the right choices with men, but she was able certainly to get them and keep them. And she thought women should be totally empowered, both in life and in love and in the professional arena.
I've been speaking with Betsy Perriello. She's a cultural historian and author of Diamonds and Deadlines, a tale of greed, deceit, and a female tycoon in the Gilded Age. Betsy, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Carrie. So much fun. Thank you again.
Our pleasure.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.